It's about time, it's 8 o'clock now for the morning talk. Is there anyone not here? Please put your hand up. Excellent. As you all know, my character over so many years, I'd always like to take life lightly. And one of the reasons for this is one of the sayings of the Buddha, and it's the Pali version is more impressive than the English translation. But the I think put the aircon on because it's a bit sort of too hot in here, so I asked them to put it down to 16 degrees or 50. In my dreams, no. No, the verse was Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati, and it's one of those little, very easy verses which I remembered very quickly, because it means from happiness the mind becomes still. It's a cause of stillness. The samadhi of the peace of the mind is happiness. And that was a very important teaching for me, because sometimes as a young Buddhist and sort of going to all the different Buddhist temples, trying to find out which Buddhist temple suited me, which teacher suited me, you went to many, many different traditions and different teachers. And I must admit that most of those teachers were misery guts. They were always fierce. Ugh, sit up straight. Ugh, don't do this. And you never saw the happiness in them. And that was one of the reasons I thought, well, you know, if this Buddhism is supposed to make you happy and get close to Nibbana, and there's another saying of the Buddha, Nibbana is the ultimate happiness, supreme happiness. So I wanted to see these monks and nuns teaching, were they happy? And if they weren't, I thought, no, that's not the teacher for me. But it was very lucky when I did find someone like an Ajahn Chah, who was a very happy monk. And you know, sometimes you see what people would do to the poor old monk. And you know, he would always tend to laugh, never get upset and angry. And sometimes, especially us Western monks, because the Western monks, we were always doing things wrong. Because you know, we weren't brought up in that culture. We didn't know what to do. We were learning from scratch. And so sometimes one of my favorite stories was the first year staying with Ajahn Chah. It was a very poor monastery. He hadn't become famous yet. A few people knew that he was a very wise monk. But I needed some soap to wash. And the only way you can get anything there, of course monks don't have any money, you can't go to the shops. The people would come and offer stuff, requisites, to Ajahn Chah, and he'd put it in his big water jar. And when he wanted something, he'd say, well, soap, and he'd look in there, see if there's any soap. Here, this is some soap, and give it to you. No choice, just, but, you know, any old soap will do. So I went to him to ask for some soap. But of course, Ajahn Chah could not speak English. So I had to learn the Thai word for soap. And Thai word for soap is sabu. But I said, Sapo. Close enough, I thought. But, you know, and he asked, what do you want Sapo for? I said, no, to wash. And Ajahn Chah almost fell off the chair. Because Sapo means, in a Northeast dialect, it means pineapple. And he said, these Westerners, they're very advanced. In Thailand, we use like this soap, but no, they use pineapple to wash. And he never, ever let me forget that. And it made him very happy. So you don't criticize people, that's the wrong word, you know, learn it again. Instead, he showed that the response to making mistakes is happiness. And then everybody learns. And of course, we made so many mistakes in those early years in Thailand. We gave so much happiness to our teacher. So many nice stories. But it confirmed for me something which, you know, reading in the Buddhist books, it is from happiness that the mind becomes still. You get inspired, uplifted. The opposite is when you get so critical and negative about yourself, about life, about a monastery, about everything. That's so easy to do. Instead, we tend to always look on the nice side of life. And of course, I was like that when I was young, so much so that even many of the friends when I was young, the Buddhist friends, when I told them I was going to go off to Thailand, I chose because it was a happy place, in those days anyway. And when I went over there, I told friends I was going to Thailand, they didn't take me seriously. And there was one gentleman, because I was looking for a place to go in Thailand to become a monk. I didn't know Ajahn Chah yet. And the monks in the Thai temple in London said, oh, go and talk to this man, he's disrobed, he's just come back from Thailand. So I asked him, said, what's a good place to ordain as a monk? And he just said all sorts of useless advice, so I forgot about it. But I saw him much later, because he had been with Ajahn Chah, and he disrobed, and he never told me. And I asked him, why didn't you tell me about Ajahn Chah? And he said, well, I took one look at you, and you were smiling. I didn't think you were serious. And he never ever thought I would survive as a monk, because I was too happy. And there's something very wrong about that. The people think you have to be strict and serious before you can do good meditation. But it is the opposite, and it's wonderful to see that being reinforced by the teachings of the Buddha. Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati, from happiness. The mind is easily comes to stillness. It is almost like the happiness I'm talking about. It's not the sensory happiness, it's more like a spiritual happiness, a peace of mind, inspiration. Now, sometimes it's just seeing, just, you know, the last piece of bread left, you know, before the breakfast finishes. And while you want that piece of bread, somebody else is already toasting it. And they take one look at you and they give it to you. A nice piece of self-sacrifice, inspiration. Any bit of joy like that, I don't know if it happens to me, and I think it happens to everybody. You notice some beautiful acts of kindness and generosity and joy, and it gives you so much happiness. And then that is what I use often, to close my eyes and just really bliss out on the goodness of others. I use that as a foundation. And then from there, it's so easy to do things like watching the breath. It's like a boost of fuel inside your tank. So the mind is very easy to actually to stay with something like the breath, to meditate, to let go, because you're happy and satisfied. Fortunately, in a place like this, there are so many kind and good people around. And every now and again you watch people looking out for one another, making sure that you do have enough breakfast or lunch. They notice that what you eat, and sometimes they put it in front of you. In other words, they're looking out for you and they're caring for you. And little things like that create a lot of happiness for you. And if you don't receive that gift yourself, there's something we call mudita, where you see other people doing these wonderful acts of kindness and generosity and goodness. Just like, again, all those people who come and bring the food every day. And hopefully you get this wonderful sense of mudita, this sympathetic joy, this celebrating in other people's goodness. And when you do things like that, oh, just the mind becomes so bright and uplifted. And it's not that hard to go from there into deep meditation. You know, sometimes I said what people did to get the deep meditations, really let go. But the cause for their deep meditations was somehow or other, somewhere, getting some inspiration, some celebration of the goodness of life, or themselves, or of others, inspired enough to really uplift you. and other people's kindness and goodness is what does that. I didn't mention that story of sometimes you get a very wonderful Dhamma talk, and that can inspire you. It inspires you so much that you get lots and lots of joy inside. And that's enough to give you the energy to be able to sit there, and your mind doesn't wander off. It doesn't wander off seeking for happiness because it's got happiness already. It's just like I remember the time when I was a school teacher. First year, you're teaching teenagers. We talked about teenagers the other day, that they never follow instructions, even in schools. Well, they have to, but it's really tough work the first year as a school teacher. And I would come home every evening and I'd just turn on the TV and anything, I didn't care what was on. Made myself a cup of tea, turn on the TV and zonk out until I got my energy back again. And just realize, just you know, in life, it does take a lot of energy to survive in this life. And sometimes that's one of the reasons why it's hard to meditate when you're so tired. But then every now and again, even though I was really tired, then sometimes you see something in life which was very inspiring. Someone did a wonderful act of kindness. Someone sort of thanked you for something which you did and you'd forgotten all about it. Somebody would just, like this years ago, one of the wonderful acts of generosity which I saw, which inspires me to this day, was when there was one Laotian lady, a refugee who came here to Perth. And you know what governments are like, they sometimes get overworked. And what happened was her whole family got sent over to the United States. You know, they're refugees from the Vietnam War and Laotian War. And when they got sent to the United States, she got sent to Perth. A big mistake. But she was separated from her mother, her father, her sisters and brothers. That was hard enough. But when she got a phone call that her mother was sick and dying, I think many of you who come from Asian countries in particular, you have to be with your mum when she's dying, if it's at all possible, if you can. And she couldn't, because you know, she was just a refugee, had no money. And she was in our center in Olamara one Friday when I was there, and she was crying her eyes out. She'd never see her mum again, because she didn't have the money to get an air ticket. And as she was doing this, it even makes me emotional today. There was another Thai lady in the back. She was out of work. She'd hurt her back and couldn't get a job. But she took out her checkbook and gave this Laotian lady a blank check. "I don't care how much it is," said this Thai girl, "go and visit your mum." And they hugged and kissed. And just, they were just acquaintances, that's all. And those beautiful acts of generosity, a blank check for a woman who really, really, really needed it. Those are the sorts of things when I think about those acts of kindness and how they make a huge difference in this world. That brings me joy. And if I wasn't speaking to you now, I'd just close my eyes and just start blissing out in deep meditation. Simply because it gives you the power to get good meditation. The opposite of that is where we start criticizing everything. "Oh, it's like this. Oh, it's like that. Oh, why do we have to have the talk at 8 o'clock? Why can't we have it at 8:30? Breakfast, why do we have to have it? Can't we have, if we paid a bit of extra money, have breakfast in bed?" It's an idea, isn't it? "No, not breakfast in bed." "Oh, come on." But anyhow, you can see just how everything here is just all given for free. No one gets paid here. Group manager, do you get paid? Leha? No. The cooks, they get paid. The teacher, does he get paid? No. And you don't want to be paid because that will take all the joy and happiness out of it. The wonderful act of giving means it inspires you, uplifts you. But it's not just that which creates happiness. There's one of the Buddha's teachings. It's the second teaching, which was given or recorded when they brought all the teachings together. It's called the Fruits of the Holy Life. And it was where one of the new king went to see the Buddha in the bamboo grove. And never seen the Buddha before. And it was asking the Buddha, why do you become a monk? You know, you could be rich and you could be comfortable like me, said this king. And the Buddha said, you just don't know what comfort is, what happiness is. And then the Buddha started explaining what happens to you when you do a real proper religious life, a spiritual life. It leads to ever-increasing happiness. And he pointed out some wonderful things, just like keeping precepts. You know, when you keep some precepts, you know, like 5 precepts here, you know, trying not to talk, being kind to one another, that creates a wonderful sense of harmony. One of my old school friends came to visit me in Thailand many, many, many years ago. And I told him one of the wonderful parts of visiting these traditional monasteries in the northeast of Thailand is the morning alms round. In the morning alms round, it's just after the sun has come up, very close to dawn, the monks would silently walk through the village, and the villagers would give some rice into the bowl. And you'd walk there silently and come back, and just once you had the rice, the other, whatever was there, curries or whatever, would be sort of offered later. But it was a very beautiful time, quiet walk in the early morning, just almost before sunrise, just after dawn. And I said, please come tomorrow morning. Now, he was a Westerner. He said, look, in London we don't get up that early for sunrise. He said, I'd love to get up, but I can't make it. I'll come afterwards. I said, no, you must come. And I told him I would be there in the morning knocking on his door. He was an old friend. I'd knock on his door of his room to wake him up and wait for him and take him on the arms round with me. Which, of course, I did the following morning. And on the way back, he said it was such a strange experience. It was unique. He never experienced that before for years. That when he went to bed, because I was a monk and I said I would be there the following morning, he knew I would, 100%. He said sometimes in the world outside, people promise all sorts of things. Sometimes it comes up, but sometimes, most times, it doesn't. But because it came from a monk, he knew that truthfulness meant that I would be there. And he made himself so wonderful experience. You could trust people. And that's what happens when, you know, you do have some virtue in this life. It makes life so much easier when you're in this retreat center here. You don't have to really lock your doors. You don't really have to hide things. You know, people will look after them for you. What a beautiful thing that is, that trust and that goodness, that kindness. It's something in the Jhana Grove Retreat Center. While we do ask people to keep those precepts, I don't tell you what those precepts are. You know, one of the reasons I don't tell you what the precepts are you're supposed to keep on the retreat center is because when I became a Buddhist, I read those precepts and thought, well, why not? I never went to some ceremony to keep precepts. What actually happened was I'd been going to the Thai temple for a while as a layman, and then one of the monks took me aside and said, you know, you've been coming here long enough now, it's about time you took the 5 precepts. And I said, well, what are the 5 precepts? He said, oh, not killing any living beings. He said, well, I don't kill any living beings. At the time I was a very strict vegetarian. And he said, oh, no, okay, not stealing. You know, I never would steal, but I had the idea, you know, as a poor student, that if the people on the bus in London didn't ask for the fare, I never needed to pay it. therefore. But you know, just after a while when you meditate, you think, well, someone has to pay for these buses. And so out came that even if you weren't asked for the fare, you would still pay it anyway. You say, excuse me, sir, you didn't ask me for the fare. And you give it to them. And they've got so much happiness and joy when you do things like that. I still remember just, you know, building this monastery, building this place. When building the monastery, we used to get supplies from the hardware store. And the goodness, the purity and the trust which the monks had got was so wonderful that when one day, getting a lot of wood from the wood store in town, and just, it happens, we had so much and there was a big rush, so there's quite a bit of wood I didn't pay for. When I came back and unloaded it from the car, I thought, oh my goodness, this wood hasn't been paid for. So I went back to the shop and said, oh, you know, there's about 50 bucks worth of wood here. You gave it to us and you were so rushed, we were rushed, we didn't pay for, so now here's the money. I remember the look on the person's face who was like looking after the counter. He looked at me as if I was mad. And he said, just hold on a moment. And then he went to see the big boss. And then the big boss came down and said, we're going to give you a discount from now on, a builder's discount. You're not builders, but nevertheless, your honesty has really impressed us. So now you have 10% off all of your orders. Actually, so we made a lot of money out of that. There wasn't the money so much, it was just the trust. It made me happy, made other people happy. And you can see just how the goodness creates a happier world. And against that, I remember going to one retreat. This was a long time ago. We didn't have our own retreat center, and this was in Safety Bay in the Penguin Road. I remember that name. The bottom of Penguin Road there was some nunnery somewhere, and there's hardly any nuns left, but they allowed us to use the place for a retreat. And when I was waiting for the next interview in a small room next to the road, it was on a Sunday, and you could actually see just outside the window, two men, they'd just been to church and they're just saying goodbye to one another. And when one man said to the other, he said, oh, be good. And the other man said, no, that's no fun. And I thought, oh, how little you understand. Being good is fun. If you want to have a good time, then be good. So I'm a good time monk. Do I look miserable and unhappy? I don't get up to any mischief, but you still have a lot of fun and happiness being kind, being trustworthy, and being generous. I can't give any money to you, don't have money, but I can give you my time, give you forgiveness, give you a smile, give you the latest joke. What's the latest joke? Oh yeah, what do you call... What do you get from a dancing cow? What do you get from a dancing cow? It's a milkshake. That's a stupid joke. But that's all I can give you, okay, sorry. But that sort of joy and uplift and happiness is something which was encouraged. So, sometimes when I became a monk, I thought those monks in time, especially those forest monks, were really strict. Now, the Ajahn Mahabodh was, and there's one monk up there, we got a photo of, he's one of my famous favorite monks, Ajahn Singtong. He had such a great sense of humor. And one of his stories, which he told me himself, because I went to visit him, and he said he was staying with this monk, Ajahn Mahabodh, who was really tough, really strict. And, you know, these monks were really strict. You know, if they needed a sort of... they had a fever, mostly sort of the... How was it called? Not the... the malaria fever or something. They would just get the... what was it called? The fluid, the drip. And they just put it in their own arms. They didn't bother with anaesthetic or anything. Just bung it in. Really tough monks. And there was one monk who was... Sometimes there's not much difference between toughness and stupidity. Because I remember one monk... I've already started this story, so I may regret this afterwards, but here we go. This one monk, I was staying with him for one range retreat. In the morning, he wasn't there for morning chanting. Nor the abbot was missing as well. I wonder where they'd gone to. So we did our morning chanting ourselves, and later on, when it came to the one meal of the day, he was sitting there, he was really grey, and his head was down, and the abbot was laughing all over his face. And I said, what happened? He said, the night before this monk, he said he got fed up was when he urinated, he could never urinate in a straight line, so he decided to circumcise himself. that is absolutely crazy. This poor monk. Ooh. So they were tough, but sometimes a bit stupid. He survived, just. But at least now he can urinate in a straight line. Anyhow, this monk, Ajahn Sing Tong, that in Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, again, very strict, if you didn't get there for the morning chanting, then you couldn't eat that day. No food. So this poor monk, he was meditating late at night, so he had a snooze, and then he got up late. Too late for the morning chanting. Oh my goodness, what should I do? So he went into the forest, and he got a chicken, a rooster. He's a village boy, easy to catch. So he caught this chicken, and he put a string around its neck, and he dragged it to the meditation, which happened after the chanting, just like here. He dragged it to the meditation hall, making all this noise. And then he went up to sit meditation, only for a few minutes. And then the bell went, and Ajahn Mahabua said, "You are late for the chanting. You can't have anything to eat today." He said, "What do you mean, Venerable? I came before the chicken." Makongai. Which in Thai is an idiom, mean you came early. And all the monks, they just fell over laughing. And even Ajahn Mahabua couldn't refuse to see the funny side of it. Oh, you can come on arms round today. You can eat. They had a wonderful sense of humour, these monks. And you could see they're very light-hearted. And that happiness, that light-heartedness was an important part and cause of their meditation. Which is one of the reasons why, when I was saying about the walking meditation, when you do the walking meditation, I will die, that's for sure. Sometimes you can actually make that a bit funny. It makes it stay with you. But after a while, the funniness turns into something serious. But it's not just to make you unhappy. It helps you let go. I will die, that's for sure. Yay! So you don't have to worry about a thing. You can make peace. Sometimes you see people, they do... I was actually going to say more about the walking meditation today instead of going into too many jokes about walking meditation, but you see sometimes people do really slow walking meditation. They just lift up very slowly and they move forward very slowly and they put their feet down very slowly. And we encourage here people to do the walking meditation at a natural pace. No need to go too fast or too slow. Keep it natural. If it's slow, then fine. If it's fast, that's fine. But anyway, there was another group doing a meditation retreat here. That was the Vipassana group. They're very welcome and they come here quite often. And anyway, that one of our visitors at lunchtime at the monastery, they said, can we just have a look? We'll be quiet. I said, yeah, sure. So they came over and had a look. And when they came back again, one of their kids, about 6 or 7 year old, he had to see me, It was important, it was an emergency. I said, why, what happened? He said, bum. He was so excited. He said, at your retreat center, there's zombies there. Lifting, walking. To a 7 year old, people doing the slow walking meditation, there's a lot of similarities between that and zombies. Especially when zombies were really popular in the media. So sometimes if I can walk past her and see somebody doing the slow walking, oh, there's another zombie. But you know, it's not a zombie meditation, it's just people smiling, enjoying the activities. And oh, the other one, a similar story. Ajahn Sumedho told me this story. When he first went to England, there was one of the disciples there. She was a clinical psychiatrist. She's working in the local mental institution. And you know, there's, again, for many people who do clinical psychology and psychiatry, they get a lot of help from Buddhist teachings. So anyway, she managed to get this big mansion in one of these villages in Sussex. And you know, it was a run-down mansion, but she was going to fix it up after many years. So the nice thing was it had like stables, which you could make into a meditation hall, and lots of rooms where people could do a retreat. It was the very first meditation retreat which they did in UK. And about 20 or 30 people were doing this retreat. And so, but you know what English villages are like? In English villages, there's always the neighbours. They look through the curtains and see what's going on. And peeking, what's happening? So one afternoon, one of the neighbours, they opened the windows and saw all these people in white clothes, as you see many of the, or some of the people keeping precepts wear white clothes. All these people wearing white clothes doing this very slow, weird walking. You know what happened next? And this was in the house, which was, they all knew in the village, had been brought by the clinical psychiatrist who worked in the local mental health institution. She rang the police. Honestly. And the police came to try and take them all back to the... But I'm not in a mental institution. I'm a Buddhist. Now, this was many years ago. On a retreat, it took a lot of explanation to realize that this was sane people doing very peaceful things. And they got away with it that time, but please be careful. But anyway, when you're doing real walking meditation, I wanted to talk about that this morning. You do real walking meditation. Because many of you know how to do sitting meditation, I haven't seen many people doing the zombie or any other type of walking meditation in there. So how you do it, you start at one end, present moment awareness, just be here, and then you start walking. You don't force the walking, keep it natural. If you need to walk fast, you walk fast. Slow, walk slow. But the main thing is you keep your awareness mostly in your legs, where you are, how you're walking. Because that's the most prominent thing which is happening when you're walking. You look at those walls, there's nothing on the walls except those stupid clocks in that room. And there's, we try and, you know, nothing much to watch through the windows. The halls are supposed to be boring. There's nothing else to watch except in this room your breath or something. Nothing much to watch when you're doing walking meditation except the feelings in your feet. You put your gaze about 2 meters in front of you, not to the left, not to the right, just a body length in front of you. That gives you the sense of safety, security. If you do, try and do closing your eyes when you're doing the walking meditation, you go bump into the wall. You've got to know where you what you're doing. So, and you just walk as aware of this present moment as you can. Now is the only time. What's in front of you, the main feeling, is just your feet moving. And you're just being kind, not rushing it, not going slow, not going fast. And then what happens is you do become very aware of just one foot moving as you begin to make the step. And you can feel just the weight moving to the stationary foot, and the other foot you can feel it start to lift off the yoga mat carpet. The yoga mat's in there. And as they do move up, you can actually start to feel all the different sensations which are necessary just to move one foot off the mat. You don't force it, but you observe it as it lifts up above. And as you have to balance, walking is a very complex procedure. As anyone in physiotherapy knows, if someone has an accident or they have a stroke, learning how to walk again is incredibly complex. And so many different muscles have to move just for one step. You can feel it happening as you move forward, and then what part of your foot touches the ground first? What touches it last? And how does the weight transfer? And you're aware of this very simple process of just one step, and then the next step. Now, just like watching the breath, some people thought that would be boring. But after a while, it becomes fascinating. Just one step, how it feels. And just how much happens just from the time that one foot is on the mat, and then as it moves up and goes forward and then goes down, and then the weight transfers again. It's like learning a dance, but it's a natural dance which you've done for all your life. You're just seeing how it works. And it becomes a wonderful help, a complementary practice to sitting meditation. You sit and you walk and you sit and you walk. I think you all know sometimes you're sitting down on a chair or on a cushion here. After a while you get a bit stiff. You do need to get up and do something. And instead of just going off and having a cup of tea or just going to your room or whatever, you can stay in this meditation hall here and just walk very little way to one of the walking meditation halls, and then do some walking meditation and come back and sit. That preserves the stillness and the quietness of your mind. It doesn't get so disturbed that way. And also in the walking meditation, some people actually prefer the walking meditation to sitting meditation. Sometimes in a walking meditation it gets so incredibly still. And the story I say about that, again, personal stories, it was my first year in Thailand, even in Bangkok. It's a noisy place. But I'd always do 1 hour walking meditation in the main hall in the morning time. And it was not as, it's probably shorter than this distance here, the main hall. And I don't know why they decided to have this, but in the main meditation hall, they had a grandfather clock, which chimed every quarter hour. And I think that's not a very good place to meditate. We're chiming, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. But nevertheless, I could time my walking by that, and without trying to force anything, it took half an hour for me to get from one end of the room to the other. And I wasn't forcing it, it was just nature. There was so much going on as you were moving the foot, I just couldn't rush it. And half an hour to go back again, and that was it. Then what happened this one day, which really let me know just how well it was working for me, that I was maybe about two-thirds through the one-hour session, and I heard this noise, like, 100 miles away. Brahmawangso. That's another full name. Brahma is a shortened version. Because, you know, when I was came over here to Australia, he said, "What's your name?" "Bamba Wang." So, "Bamba what?" So we shortened it to Brahm. But please, please don't shorten it any further. Because that actually happened. I went to give a talk on Buddhism in a girls' school, a Mercedes school. I still remember it. And the day afterwards, a couple of the schoolgirls, they saw me in Perth. And they came up to me and said, "Oh, you're the monk who gave a talk at our school yesterday." And I said, "I'm so surprised you still remember me." He said, "We'll never forget you." "Oh, isn't that nice?" "How can you ever forget a monk called Ajahn Brah?" So there's an M on the end. So anyway, they heard the sound. "Brahma Wang So. Brahma Wang So." Like a long distance away. And so, you know, you move your attention away from your feet to the source of the noise. And it was, I could see in the corner of my eye, there was a monk standing next to me, shouting in my ear. And honestly, that's what it sounded like. It sounded like a long distance away. Because I was really deep in the meditation, watching the movement of my feet. And then I remembered that I was supposed to go to a ceremony that morning, like a dharana, and I was late. And they'd sent this monk to come and get me. But fortunately, it was a monk, so they knew what meditation was. And so they knew there's no way that with the best will in the world, I could just come out quickly. It's Baba Wang So. And so I decided I'd have to sort of pay attention to him. So I started to move my head around because he was over here next to me. And you know, it's amazing just how many muscles have to move for your head to turn around. And I was fascinated with all these muscles which having to move when you turn your head around. I was trying to do it as fast as I possibly could, but I couldn't. When I did finally turn around and see him, what? Sometimes you think you're crazy when you get peaceful in meditation, but that's as fast as you can go. So you can get very peaceful when you're doing walking meditation, so just please enjoy it as much as you can. So what happens? You get, you know, first of all, maybe just notice you're walking, left foot moving, right foot moving, left foot moving. And as you get deeper in the meditation, more awareness, you get what you call the full awareness of one step, like the full awareness of the breath in breath meditation. In the very beginning of the foot moving up, and you see all of the different movements until it finally rests on the ground at the end of one step. It was fascinating. You get the full awareness of the step. Then you get the delightful step. Again, this is took years and years to understand why it is just one step can be so delightful, so fascinating, so enjoyable. Why is one breath so enjoyable? When you get into the deep meditations of the delightful breath with Piti Sukha coming up. Piti Sukha is a joy and happiness which comes up in meditation. Where is that coming from? And of course, you know, you look at how the Buddha taught, and it is coming from the mind. It's not a physical feeling now, it's a citta sankhara, it's made from the mind. The joy and the happiness of stillness and peace. And even when you're walking, it becomes so beautiful, so delightful. And sometimes it's just, you're just watching, the legs are doing the walking, you're just doing the watching. You don't decide, it does it by itself. You've been walking such a long time, you don't need to tell the body what to do. It just does it. And it becomes delightful. Having a wonderful time, really enjoying yourself. Same with watching the delightful breath, it's so enjoyable. So it starts with joy, allowing these beautiful states of mind to come up, and it continues with making more joy and happiness. And I mention that, the joy and happiness, because if you don't have joy and happiness with the breath or with the walking, the mind will automatically look for some happiness somewhere else. You go and it's data bank of fantasies and dreams and memories and fantasies for the future, plans and hopes. It looked for anywhere to give itself a bit of a high. The mind needs that. And if you don't get it in nature, in meditation, you'll find it in all sorts of other fantasies and dreams. What is our wandering mind? But if it has it already in the happiness of inspiration, of goodness, of kindness, generosity, if it has it there already, then you'll find you don't need to go wandering anywhere. You have the happiness right now. You have that joy. And it just gets more and more and more as you get more and more still. And as you get more and more still, I haven't talked too much about it yet, but you know, all the understanding and the insights, where do they come from? And I think you all know that all the stuff which I teach, yeah, you look back and you can quote the Buddha on this, but all those insights which I have, which makes lots of people come and come to these meditation retreats, they all come from your own experience. What do I mean by that? Again, that wonderful stimuli which I mentioned the first day of this retreat, the still forest pool. If you go and see a lake in a forest, or in a mountain is better, especially if it's on a moon night, like a full moon night. And if you're fortunate enough that that evening is still, there's no wind, and you look at that lake up in the mountains, it's like a mirror, it's like glass. But if there's any movement on that lake, any ripples or any sort of, say like a duck swimming on it or something, then that disturbs the surface. It means any reflections on that lake are distorted. But if that lake is perfectly smooth and still, you get an accurate reflection of the moon and the stars in the heaven above. That's why many Asian cultures, they say the best way to see the moon is when it's reflected in the still mountain lake. It's the most enjoyable, but it's also the most informative about how wisdom happens. From happiness you get stillness. From stillness you get wisdom, insight, which is undistorted. So that's one of the reasons why over in these retreats you really emphasize doing the walking meditation and also the sitting meditation and also the eating meditation, which I mentioned in brief. How do you do eating meditation? It is called the one spoon at a time practice. In other words, when you're eating, you've heard me say this before, you put food in your mouth. And I've seen other people doing this, look at them. They've got one food in their mouth. They've got another morsel of food on their spoon, waiting next. And they're also looking around, moving their food this way and that way on their plate. What they're going to do next. Usually about at least 3 spoons ahead of themselves. Maybe 4 spoons. And to do the one spoon at a time practice, it means that one spoon, pick it up, you put it in your mouth, and you enjoy it, you taste it, instead of worrying about what you're going to have next. And only when you finish that one spoon of food, and you swallowed it, only then do you put anything else on your spoon for the next. Only then do you decide what comes next. Present moment awareness with eating. And as I said, and it's quite true, but if you do that, you're really there with one morsel of food at a time, what's actually in your mouth, rather than looking at what's done on the plate. If you do that, it means you digest much better. But be careful be careful, don't do that too well, otherwise you'll end up like me. I digest my food so well that I absorb much more of my food than you do. Which is my excuse for this. But whatever, it's a beautiful practice. You're actually learning how to be here. You're actually slowing down. And you're being aware in this moment, whether you're walking, whether you're sitting, or whether you lie down to go to bed at night. Now this story introduces the lying down meditation. And this is a very famous story of the Buddha's attendant, Ananda. For those of you who know the Buddha's history, Ananda was the Buddha's attendant for 25 years and heard so many great lectures from the Buddha, saw so many wonderful monks and nuns become fully enlightened. But as for him, even when the Buddha passed away, he wasn't fully enlightened yet. Oh my goodness. Everyone else, yes, him, no. So he was very disappointed. And especially when they had the first council, a conference, getting as many enlightened monks together as possible so they can gather all the teachings together, what became known as the suttas, and the Vinaya, getting all of them together there and reciting them all. And so they selected 499 fully enlightened ones. And the 500th was Ananda. They said he has to come, even though he's not fully enlightened, because he's been with the Buddha for such a long time, he's heard so much, surely we must invite him. So the following day, there was going to be this big conference, 499 arahats, and Ananda the 500th, who wasn't enlightened yet. And to understand what it must feel like, imagine at the end of this retreat, I made the announcement that every one of you was enlightened except for you. How would you feel? He'd be pissed off. And there's a big meeting the following morning. So Ananda said, right, tonight, I'm going to really go for it. He never slept all night, meditating, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, really going for enlightenment, trying his best. And as the dawn rose in the morning, nowhere. As far off from enlightenment, he thought, as when he started. So what did he do? He knew that it was only about an hour before the meeting started. That's enough time to have a nap. So he went to his room. And he went to lay down. And as many of you know, before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened monk to go to that meeting. He got enlightened as he was laying down. That's why I encourage that meditation for you. It worked for Venerable Ananda. Maybe it'll work for you. Obviously, why did that work? Because he was letting go. He had everything there, just needed to let it go, to really let go. That's what he did. He was late for the meeting, just to give the final part of the story. He arrived late, on purpose. And they locked the door. And so how did he enter? He came in through the keyhole. Big light came through the keyhole, and then he manifested. Otherwise, I wouldn't have believed him. It's called making an entrance. And he did. The 500th enlightened being in that meeting there. So anyway, so that's what we call, if you get a bit tired today, you can do the try the Ananda method of meditation. But no, not just that, because there'll be times in your life when you're sick. You know, when you can't sort of sit even on a chair or do walking meditation. You're bedridden. And that will happen to each one of us sooner or later in life, if it hasn't happened already. It doesn't mean you can't meditate when you're lying down. So how do you meditate when you're lying down? You make sure your body is comfortable as best you can. And then you sort of, in the present moment, be with whatever's happening right now is the most important thing in the whole world. And be kind and see what happens next. I know that's possible, because one of the experiences I had, all the Western monks in this monastery in Thailand called Wat Nanachat, we all eventually got typhus fever, scrub typhus. It was the same symptoms as typhoid, but when they checked us, there was no typhoid fever. They didn't know what it was. It was a very heavy fever. They never checked for scrub typhus because the health organization in Thailand said there's no scrub typhus in that part of the world. There wasn't for the Thais, for the locals. But the visitors, like me, we got scrub typhus. And it was a very heavy fever for many weeks. And that was the time when all the idea of, like, especially Thai girls being like petite and pretty and soft, because the nurses in the monks' ward at Ubon Hospital were Thai nurses. They weren't petite and gentle. The one which was looking after me was built like water buffalo. She was big. She had to be, because twice a day, and I was there for about a month. Twice a day they'd give you a cocktail of antibiotics, injecting. And I've mentioned this, and I think this is not too far from the truth. This was a third world country in those days. And Bangkok was sort of developed. But Ubon, the provinces of northeast, that was a poor part of the world. That was the backwaters. There was indigenous livelihood. So those days, not just one-use needles, they always recycled the needles. And I'm sure they'd be used in Bangkok first, and once they couldn't sharpen them up anymore, they'd send them up to the northeast for the Isan people. And they'd use them on the ordinary farmers first of all, and last of all, on the monks. So those were really dull needles. I knew that because I could feel it. So the nurse would never inject you. That's why she had to be big like water buffaloes. Never injected you. Stabbed you. Twice a day in the bottom. All right. I was a young monk, okay. It's only my first, second year as a monk. And even though I had lots of loving kindness, but not for her. I admit it. Do your charity. May all beings be happy and well, but not that nurse. That really hurt. Especially now, every day, in the morning, afternoon, sort of after 3 or 4 weeks, there's a very sore backside. But that wasn't the worst thing about having a fever in a hospital. The worst thing, of course, was you just no energy at all, just totally wiped out. And to go to the toilet, you know, you had no, there's no one there to help you, no attendants or anything. No, even bedpans. That would have been wonderful to have a bedpan. You had to just drag yourself up and hold on to the, I remember this, hold on to the end of the bed, you know, the metal railings. And when you had enough energy to lurch, fall over to the next one, and then hold on there for a while, and then lurch to the next one. So it was like an expedition, like climbing Mount Everest to go to the toilet. And so when you got there, you made sure you spent enough time there, you didn't have to go back too soon. And so no energy at all. But then I decided one afternoon, this is when Ajahn Chah, the great master, came to see me. You know what he did? Famous. He did it to all the monks, at least most of the monks in those days. He was very wise, but his bedside manner was not that good. he came up to me and said, Bama Wangso. And I was just, he was going to talk to me, and I felt so uplifted. He came to see me. You'll either get better or you'll die. And then he left. That's what he said. You can't argue with that, can you? It's true. It's not what you needed. Maybe it was what I needed. But anyway, I didn't die. I got better. But then, not having any support anywhere, so I just, this one afternoon, I decided to meditate. I don't know why. You think you can't meditate because you've got no energy, you've got fever, you're really tired, sore bottom. And I was just lying on the bed, lying there, and then decided to really let go. Really let go. And go into this marvelous meditation. And because the body was tired, aching, in pain, I probably had a fever, most of the time, because of that, the contrast was immense. The body disappeared. You're just blissing out inside in your mind. What it did to me, and the reason I say this, is because you can do it. It's possible. Lying down, even with a fever, in pain, dying if you wish, there's still no reason why you can't get into the best meditations. So doing the lying down meditation is possible, and it does work. Especially when you go to bed at night, after the talks, sometimes so many people have done this. They've been meditating all day, haven't been getting very far. They go to bed. As soon as the head hits the pillow, there's beautiful lights come up in the mind, nimittas. I don't know, I say that because people come and say, well, what's going on? I was sitting here trying to meditate, I couldn't do it. I went to bed, and it just happened naturally. So why is it that when people are meditating here in front of me, they get sleepy, they fall asleep, and when they go to bed at night, they can't sleep? So I tell people, oh, it's okay then. What to do is when you're in the room here, try to go to sleep. Then maybe you'll meditate well. And when you go to bed at night, try to meditate and you fall fast asleep. But no, what is happening there? Because you're letting go, you're not trying anymore. It's your sleep time. You lay down, you let go, and the mind gets very peaceful and still. That happens. So doing the lying down meditation, that's a traditional way of meditating. And see if it works for you. So you've got all these postures you can meditate in. Lying down, eating, sleeping, sitting on the toilet bowl. If you're sitting on the toilet bowl, really let go. Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. And sometimes people are asking me about the interviews. It's not just one day on interviews. So we have interviews every day. And you can go to more than one interview, but don't just go every day. Once in the morning, once in the afternoon. Give other people a chance. But if there's something you really need, some advice, please come and ask.